What's up, shitpost? This is your host, Jared Holt, back at you with another episode of the show. This one I'm really excited about. We've got Michael Hobbs joining us here in just a minute. He's going to talk about moral panics and how the media can enable them sometimes. Moral panics have existed throughout our society. There was the satanic panic. There were worries that metal music were going to turn people satanic. There's the, you know, razor blades in Halloween candy. I mean, these things tend to just kind of come in and out of style. When one subdues, another seems to take its place. And moral panics, they get people scared. And when people get scared, they do things that aren't rational and they do things that aren't helpful, sometimes even detrimental. That's why I think it's so important to talk about moral panics, especially in the political context that Michael and I are going to talk about on this episode. But before we get started, I do have to plug shtpost.substack.com. We have had a lot of growth of this show as far as financial support goes, and that's enabled us to do a lot of really cool things. Like we've brought on Sam Thielman, who is editing the newsletters now. I'm of the personal opinion that they are so much, you know, stronger and better. And, you know, I want to keep building this project and, you know, pay people fair rates of what they deserve to get paid. And I do that with the support that I get from listeners and readers. And we have been able to do that recently. And I'm floored. Thank you so much. And if you want to contribute to this project, if you're financially able to, shtpost.substack.com is where you can go to do it. And now that I got the most shameless part of this show out of the way, let's go now to my conversation with Michael Hobbs. Joining Shitpost now, we have Michael Hobbs. You might have read his work in HuffPost. You might have heard his voice on the podcast You're Wrong About, which he co-hosted with Sarah Marshall, and he co-hosts a podcast called Maintenance Phase. Michael, that is quite a lengthy intro for a guest. How are you doing?
I'm great. Big fan of the show. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I hope you're getting some sleep in between some of that stuff.
Well, I just left one podcast, so I have slightly more time for sleeping now.
Oh, but you're still writing, and that's why I wanted to have you on today. You wrote this piece for your Substack called The Methods of Moral Panic Journalism, and it really resonated with me a lot. I think this is a really good way to frame it, and we'll talk about that as our conversation keeps going. But to think about the kind of stories that it seems like we see every week coming out in places like The Atlantic, the New York Times opinion page, the Wall Street Journal opinion page, like these giant bastions that are reaching millions of people. And it's all, you know, it's like kind of beat to death at this point, but it's wokeness, it's cancel culture. It is illiberalism, in fact, from the liberals. How about that? And to think of that as a moral panic, the same way we might think of like the satanic panic of the like 80s, early 90s, and you know, you open up talking about the frivolous lawsuit panic that sort of ensued, and you start with the example of the McDonald's coffee lawsuit, which I think most people have probably heard of. If you haven't, a woman sued McDonald's after spilling coffee on herself. She got third-degree burns and asked McDonald's to pay her medical costs. McDonald's says no. She filed a lawsuit. But this became the subject of, you know, cultural mockery, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a two-decade-long moral panic, and the McDonald's hot coffee case became this symbol of how lawsuits in America were out of control. And in America, everybody sues everybody for everything now. And it just became this sort of this way of kind of rolling your eyes at the kind of country that America had become. And the McDonald's hot coffee example is really instructive because in the sort of the media version of it, it was like, oh my God, can you believe it? Like, this woman was driving, she spilled some, you know, lukewarm coffee on herself, and then she sued and got rich. You know, they called it jackpot justice at the time. And they said, you know, anybody can sue a company for anything these days. And, you know, minor inconvenience, you know, she got a stain on her pants or something, and now she's rich. Like, that was sort of the story that went around, and of course gets reproduced in a million, you know, late night jokes. And these sort of one sentence asides in articles about lawsuits, they're like, ugh, like that woman who sued McDonald's, right? And the real story is like really awful. It's this woman, she wasn't driving. The coffee, McDonald's at the time kept its coffee almost at boiling. And when she spilled it on herself, she got third degree burns. She spent a week in the hospital. She was never the same. She was basically disabled for the rest of her life. And she didn't really get that much money. Originally, she got a almost $3 million settlement. But as these cases almost always are, that was knocked down to $640,000. And she ended up settling out of court for much less than that. We don't actually know how much. But it was, you know, in the sort of in the specifics and in the particulars, you're like, oh, well, this is actually, you know, a corporation that's actually acting in a really bad way. And they had been sued 700 other times for exactly this thing. And it's actually quite reasonable when you tell the story in detail. But because there had been this pre-existing panic that Americans are, you know, too quick to sue each other, it just sort of became grist for the culture war mill. It was just something that people said about America. And if you go back, there's dozens, hundreds of stories about, you'll never guess what Americans are suing each other over now. And when you look back now, you know, people have done the analyses. And it turns out in the 1990s, when this panic hit its peak, Americans were suing each other less than they had before. Lawsuits were actually going down. And the kinds of punitive damages, you know, these million-dollar awards that you always read about, those only happen in roughly 3% of cases. And the median award was, I believe, $38,000. So it's these anecdotes, like the McDonald's case, that bounced around, and they came to be seen as sort of really common. You know, this McDonald's-style lawsuit is happening all the time, when actually these are mostly very rare occurrences, and they're not happening the way that they were being presented.
Now, so that seems like I don't want to make any assumptions here, Michael, but it does. I'm starting to sense a theme here, which,
yeah, I'm clearly teeing this up.
So let me just go ahead and set you up. Why'd you choose this example, Michael?
If only there was some sort of parallel to today. I mean, I think, you know, I did this podcast for 3 years called You're Wrong About. We did 130 episodes, and it was about stories that the media got wrong sort of on the first go-round. And we didn't really intend for this to happen, but the more of these stories you look into, you find really familiar patterns. So the frivolous lawsuits panic, you know, this thing that basically didn't happen, but there were these anecdotes that made it seem like it was happening and this coverage that made it seem like it was happening. We had exactly the same thing with the stranger danger panic, you know, creeps in white vans kidnapping kids. We had it with, you know, razor blades and apples at Halloween. We had it with street gangs. We had it with rainbow parties. I mean, the same thing keeps happening over and over again. And once you know these patterns and like the methods, the way that these non-trends are written about in the media, you start to spot them while they're taking place. And that's like a lengthy intro, but it's like once you start looking at the world like this, you can't not see it in all of these articles about quote-unquote left-wing liberalism or cancel culture or, as you said, it has 50 million names, but it's basically this idea that left-wing people are getting too left-wing and are somehow putting us on this slippery slope to some sort of totalitarian, authoritarian regime.
Yeah, what gets me about this latest trend, you know, I feel like we got not a break because it kind of stuck around, but like this is a very like 1990s, you know, PC culture type of thing. And
oh, yeah.
It feels like during the Bush era, there was a little bit of, you know, they sort of turned the volume down a little bit on it because Republican was in office and most of these talking points come from Republicans. And then the Obama years came back, so then it was all about college campuses again. Mm-hmm. And in most recent memory, I think for a lot of people that listen to this show, you'll remember like anti-SJWism around 2015. So anti-social mm-hmm. justice warriors, the campuses are filled with, your granddaughter in purple hair saying that she is a frog sexual or some like that. Yeah. That's sort of the way they spin it. And Charlie Kirk has made a fuck ton of money saying that he has the secret sauce. You know, there's all these people raising political money about it now. It got acknowledged by Trump in office, blah, blah, blah. I could spend way too much time on that. But I think that, you know, it's really interesting that, A, this has persisted for so long, and B, that it seems like people are kind of finally starting to get it. Maybe this is just my own Twitter echo chamber or whatever, but it seems like people are starting to kind of realize how this works and how it happens. But, you know, we keep going in this same circle, right?
And it's the same meta-narrative, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know, it's so frustrating. Anyway, back to your piece, Michael. I'm sorry.
I think there's sort of two pieces of it, because there's the right-wing, like, very obvious sort of grifter side of it, of, like, feminists, blah, 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 and, like, you know, all of their, it's the same stuff, and it's really repetitive if you ever go over to Breitbart or whatever. It's the same narrative. But then what's so interesting to me from a structural perspective is the way that these same narratives, these right-wing Ben Shapiro narratives, get laundered into the respectable mainstream by institutions like The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Economist, these media institutions that are seen as credible, that are very, you know, very important media outlets for the left and for liberals, and they end up repeating the exact same talking points of these right-wing grifter narratives, but they do it in this weird sort of just asking questions, a little bit more like polite, reasonable concerns kind of way. And so a lot of people like that I know, like when I talk to my parents' friends, these are like nice, liberal, educated people. And they will say things like, well, you know, what's going on college campuses? You know, it's really worrying the way these kids are just like, they're not letting anybody speak. And you can't have open debate on these campuses anymore. And it's like, where are they getting this? Like, they're not reading Breitbart. They're getting it from The New York Times and The Atlantic. But they're getting this like polite, like we should be concerned about this kind of tone, as opposed to the right wing is whipping up panic about something that does not meaningfully exist. Like, they're not getting any debunking narrative. They're just getting these questions and this, like, sense that there's a crisis, but there's never any actual information or any actual substance to back up that that is a crisis.
And that gets me into the four identifiers that you lined out in your piece. Again, it's called The Methods of Moral Panic Journalism. I'll have a link to it in the description. Low stakes, irrelevant examples, misleading stats, false equivalents. You know, a SparkNotes version, you know, if we just walk through some of these, it could be helpful for the listener because, like you said, Michael, all of these stories have kind of the same little tricks up their sleeve, and they're not very clever tricks.
No.
But if you know what to look for and you can kind of be on guard for them, you can kind of, you know, hopefully cut through the bullshit a little bit more. So low stakes. Let's talk about low stakes.
Well, I mean, so many of these articles rest on anecdotes, right? And if you pepper an article with enough anecdotes, it makes it seem like something can be very widespread in the population. But of course, we live in a country of 330 million people. And like, you know, there's all this stuff about cancel culture, but thousands of Americans lose their jobs every single day because it's a big country. And so you could easily go through and pluck out stories of, well, 10 people yesterday lost their job for this reason or for that reason. And if you highlight those anecdotes, you can make it seem like there is a particular trend going on in the country, even when actual data does not provide any evidence for that actually happening.
Yeah, it reminds me of the stories about like firefighters that are quitting firefighting because they don't want to get a vaccine. And you look at it and it's like 30 guys. And then it's like, how many firefighters are there? And it's not a thing. It's not a thing. Like these guys are just saying, fuck you, and trying to like make some weird little political stand.
Right.
But that's not, you don't have to tell a national audience about that. No one gives a shit.
Exactly. And it's not contextualized as like, here's a wacky thing that happened that, you know, a rare, weird thing that happened. It's like, this is a wave that's like cresting upon the nation or something. It's always described as a subset of a larger trend, but then the larger trend is never actually given any substance. There's never any evidence that the larger trend is happening. So one of the low-stakes anecdotes that is recounted in this piece by Anne Applebaum in The Atlantic called, of course, The New Puritans, because the left is just like people doing witch hunts, is the story of Ian Buruma, who was the editor of the New York Review of Books. And as described in the Applebaum article, it's like, you know, all he did was publish an essay by someone who had previously been accused of abuse. And then, you know, basically these crazy feminists ran him out of his job. And now his reputation is destroyed to the point where, like, he can't even get published anymore. Like, they've destroyed this man's career. And of course, it's, you know, as usual, it's described in this truncated way. The same way the McDonald's lawsuit was told in this truncated way. Like, this woman spilled some coffee and now she's rich, right?
Yeah, which, if that was true, if that's the only information you had to go off of, sounds pretty fucked up.
Yeah, you're like, oh my God, like, this injustice has occurred, right? But then, just like with the McDonald's story, you go to the specifics, and Ian Buruma printed it wasn't just like an essay by someone who had been accused of assault. It was an essay by someone who was defending himself against the assault allegations and was claiming that he was the subject of a witch hunt. And Ian Buruma, who had platformed this guy for an extremely prominent and extremely prestigious magazine, admitted that he didn't do any work to see whether anything he was saying was true. So he basically published someone accused of abuse without fact-checking anything and without asking any of the victims for a chance to do a rebuttal. And so people were mad about this. Like, people at his own magazine were like, these are not the editorial standards, the ethical standards that we as a magazine apply to our journalism. And you circumvented those things. And the public was mad. The employees were mad. And yeah, the guy stepped down. And that's actually, like, this is a totally routine thing that happens in journalism all the time, right? That, like, someone plagiarizes or someone makes an ethical violation in an article, and then their career suffers, their reputation as a journalist suffers. This is actually, like, how it's supposed to work in a professional field. If you do something bad in dentistry, the other dentists are going to be like, yeah, this guy sucks, don't hire him as a dentist. This is a completely normal thing that happened, and the stakes are unbelievably low. Like, he's already moved on to another job, he's fine, no one has died, no one's in the gulag, right? But it's like, we're supposed to see this as, you know, the tip of this, like, much broader iceberg of illiberalism, but there's no iceberg underneath it. It's just this story, and the story doesn't hold up to any scrutiny.
Yeah, it's just like, this guy got lazy and made a major screw-up at his job, and now he doesn't have a job anymore.
Yeah, and there's no human right to be the editor of a national magazine. I mean, these are extremely important positions for informing the public, and it actually feels to me like these jobs should be relatively easy to lose if you commit, like, a pretty blatant ethical violation. Like, I don't think that what happened here is an injustice on any grand scheme, and it's certainly not a sign of, like, illiberalism that employees objected to an ethical violation by their boss. This is totally normal.
I'm just trying to imagine, like, how these stories would be framed outside of, because they often take place in, like, media navel gazing or universities or something. I'm trying to imagine where it's just like, Joe Bob crashed his forklift into the warehouse and destroyed $50,000 worth of merchandise, and now he doesn't have a job. Wow.
Right.
I guess America is just not the place where you can grow anymore.
I know. And you immediately leap to the most dystopian version of the event, right? It's not just like an editor lost his job. It's like, you can't even speak in America anymore. And it's like, well, if that was true, then we need much more evidence than one anecdote of one dude.
Oh, yeah, you kind of touch on it in your piece, but my favorite thing is when people are like, wow, it looks like we're really going the way of Stalin. And
oh my God.
You know, I think most of them are wise enough to know that they shouldn't compare anything to Nazi Germany.
Yeah, but that's off the table now.
But they pick, like, you know, Mussolini's Italy, I've seen before. The Mao regime comes up
a lot. Yeah, Cultural Revolution. Yeah. You get a lot of Mao references these days, yeah.
which is just, that should be, I would like to expand Godwin's Law on the internet.
I know, where
if you mention any sort of, like, historical, you know, communist or Nazi regime or something, you should just immediately get the eject button out of whatever conversation.
There's also, I mean, I also think there's a really interesting tendency that they'll do the thing that they'll compare these, you know, nothing burger anecdotes to, you know, McCarthyism or, you know, literal witch hunts, as in the case of the title of Anne Applebaum's article. But then in the article, you know, paragraph 7, they'll be like, well, obviously we're not in the middle of a cultural revolution, you know, this isn't anything like Mao, but, and then they'll just kind of keep going. So it's like this weird acknowledgement within the story that is like, well, this story basically shouldn't exist, right? It's like, I'm going to compare it to witch hunts. And then we're like, well, you know, nobody's dying. And the witch hunts had like very specific cultural and historical specifics to them that don't really apply here. But anyway, this is just like a witch hunt.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, it's undermining its own case. And then that gives you the armor when people push back and they're like, well, you're not really comparing college sophomores to Mao, are you? Then they'll be like, well, I actually said in paragraph 7 that they're not like Mao.
Did you read the piece? Right. Did you read the piece, Michael?
Right. Exactly. And it's like, it's a 12,000 word piece. And like 18 of those words are like, no, it's not like Mao at all. And then the rest of it is like, this is just like Mao. So like, of course people walk away with that impression. And of course, all the art is about like nooses being around people's necks. Like the overall vibe, the narrative that the article pushes is that this is extremely dangerous. Like this is a very worrying trend in America. And it is a path toward literal totalitarian dictatorship. But there's like this asterisk of like, well, that's not really going to lead us to a dictatorship. Well, like, okay, then don't write the article saying that it will then.
All right, let's click through some of the next three. You got irrelevant examples, misleading stats, false equivalents. I think we kind of touched on the irrelevant examples. You know, you're arguing for the place of this is a trend and bringing in these kind of weird anecdotes that don't totally make sense. Is there anything else you wanted to add on that?
Well, I mean, just the fact that there's oftentimes – the example I use in the piece is that they'll say like, you know, the lefties are banning books now. Look what happened to J.K. Rowling. And it's like, right, her books weren't banned. So it's not – it's – you can't say this is an example of X and then describe something that isn't X. So just a lot of it is like you're looking – like the articles don't even hold together on their own terms. Like even at a paragraph level, you're like, well, that's not an example of the thing that you're saying is a problem. So – if you can't come up with any examples of the left banning books, then the left isn't banning books. Just straightforwardly, they're not banning books.
And I just want to jump in and say that I think a lot of this has to do with my suspicion that like the people writing these columns are terribly under-socialized or like under-socialized outside of their own very specific like elitist type of circle. And they're like, my theory is that the way they gauge the temperature of the nation is to log on to twitter.com. And they're like,
oh my God,
oh, how could they do this to the beloved Harry Potter author? And like,
yes,
you know, it's, that's my theory. You don't have to comment on it weigh in on it or anything.
I mean, I really do think that it's telling to me that everybody who's pushing this is older, white, relatively wealthy establishment journalist who is like center left. And if you are someone in that demographic, if you are someone with the opinions of somebody like that, you get yelled at a lot on Twitter because Twitter skews very young, Twitter skews very left. It is not a remotely representative sample of the US population, and people should not be going there to get a sense of what the country is like. Partly because it's not a representative sample, and also because people do not act on Twitter the way that they act in real life, right? I'm perfectly happy to sit down with my like Trump voting relatives and have like a civilized conversation about politics. I don't do that on Twitter because that's not what Twitter is for, right? So everything is just sort of at a heightened level on Twitter. So I think a lot of these writers literally, they get yelled at a lot on Twitter. And so instead of just deciding that, look, it sucks for me to be on Twitter. And, like, people on Twitter are assholes. Like, they're absolutely correct about that. They've expanded this into, like, no, it's a national crisis. And you oftentimes hear these journalists say things like, well, it could happen to anybody. Like, anyone could lose their job. And, like, we're talking about the editor of the New York Review of Books. Like, that's not anybody. That's not, like, a normal person. That's an extremely public figure with a powerful position. And when you try to get examples of, like, normal people losing their jobs over what they said on Twitter, it's like there's a couple examples that always go around, but it's like the same three examples. And, you know, I've talked to labor lawyers about this. The labor lawyer that I talked to has worked on around 500 cases. He said he's only seen two where social media had anything to do with somebody getting fired. Like, people are not getting fired for their political opinions on Twitter. This is not actually a risk for, like, most of the country, the vast majority of the country. But if you're a writer, it's kind of a risk for you. And if you're a writer with those kind of centrist lib positions, you get yelled at a lot And you start to think that, like, oh, the people yelling at me are, like, Maoists and they're going to take over. I think it's actually, like, a very normal human thing. But I do expect magazine writers and especially magazine editors to notice these human impulses and say, this is actually something that every older generation has said about every younger generation since, like, ancient Rome. So if you're going to do, like, a kids these days case, we need some better evidence for it than, like, five anecdotes and one misrepresented statistic. And they're not doing that.
Yeah, and I agree. I think it's a very human impulse, especially if you're looking at, you know, something like that happening and thinking, oh, I could lose my job because I kind of have some of those views and I'm on social media. And, like, I get that, right? I get it. That's a normal fear. But, it shouldn't translate into the work. And also, you're writing for the public, you know, helping kind of guide the national discourse. Like, the responsibility is higher for you. I'm sorry, you have to hit kind of a high bar to get there. You don't... You aren't owed this job. Misleading stats, that's pretty straightforward. And false equivalents. Was there anything you wanted to say about those two methods of moral panic journalism?
I mean, a lot of the statistics, you know, we're being told that there's a free speech crisis and we're, you know, slipping down toward totalitarianism. And then you look at the statistics, you know, this is a very bold claim. I need good evidence to come to believe this, right? But then you look at the evidence, and it's like one study that the Cato Institute did where they like asked college students, like, do you ever hold your tongue because you're afraid of, you know, offending somebody? And like, I don't know, 68% of people or something like that said yes. Like, sometimes I don't say stuff that I think because it might offend somebody. And it's like, okay, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I do that all the time. Most people do that all the time. Like, you're afraid that you might hurt somebody's feelings, so you don't speak up. Or like, if you're at work... Like, most people can't express their political opinions at work. And, like, I don't think that's good, but, like, that's a separate issue from some sort of creeping left-wing totalitarianism. Like, how many people have workplaces where they could wear, like, a defund the police t-shirt to work? Like, you can't wear that if you work at Starbucks. And, like, yeah, you also can't wear a, like, you know, gay marriage is wrong t-shirt. But, like, a lot of places in America, you just can't really do political expression. And that's a whole separate issue, and there's nothing particularly left-wing about that. That's like just an overall America problem.
Right, right. And then there's the false equivalence. I think we touched on that element of it, this sort of, you know, invoking these historical comparisons that really don't make any sense, right? You know, moments in history where regimes have literally, like, kicked people out of their homes or murdered them for... Yes. Dissent versus
government direction.
Yeah, versus people on Twitter. You know, we, for better or for worse, live in the era of like more speech happening than or public speech happening than ever, thanks to the internet. And because everybody quote tweeted someone like Barry Weiss being like, "Shut up, idiot."
Right.
We're in this moral panic.
Yeah, and you know the retort that you always get to these kinds of arguments is like, well, you know, people on Twitter really are terrible. And like, there is this sort of like witch hunty kind of vibe among the left right now. And on some level, like, that's true. I think some of the stuff that people say on Twitter is like way overblown. And I, you know, there's cases of people being shamed on Twitter for like pretty benign things. And, you know, social media is transforming society in a lot of ways. And some of those ways aren't good. And I agree with all that. Like, I think there's a real discussion to be had there. But what we're seeing is article after article in mainstream establishment papers explicitly accusing left-wing people of wanting a totalitarian dictatorship. And at the same time, we have a Republican Party that is like taking away voting rights, taking away the right to protest, completely destroying the right to abortion. Like, I mean, it's so boring to list this stuff off, but it's like there's so much happening that is extremely troubling for democracy from elected leaders. And somehow we're supposed to care that like a sophomore at Oberlin like threw a glass of water at a campus speaker. And, you know, like you couldn't even like that stupid thing where Sarah Huckabee was asked to leave a restaurant. And there was like this whole dumb, like week-long thing about civility. And like every elected Democrat was like, I think it's really bad. Like that restaurant owner should not have done that. And it's like, okay, like the left can't even do like really basic stuff like politely asking a Republican to leave a restaurant without every Democrat being like, this was bad, we need to be more civil, right?
Right.
So the power structure of Democrats does not show any of the signs that you would need for totalitarian creep, right? Like we just don't have Joe Biden be like, yeah, riot, like throw garbage cans through windows, everybody in Minneapolis. Like that's not happening. And yet on the right, we have elected leaders who are like trying to overthrow an election result, who are just, you know, playing into deranged conspiracy theories, who, you know, stormed the Capitol. And it seems like some of the people in Congress were like maybe knew about it in advance. And like, again, it's boring to list off all this stuff, but it's like, well, on one side, we have elected leaders, people in power who are encouraging like totalitarian creep types of behaviors. And on the other side, we have, you know, random people, like it's a big country, random people doing some like pretty stupid stuff. And everyone in power saying you shouldn't do stupid stuff.
Yeah.
So where's the creep coming from exactly?
Yeah, my favorite parts of these articles are like they're juxtaposition, right? Where it's like on the front page of The Atlantic or you open The Atlantic, it's like the new Puritans. Could the left be burning people at the stake? And then the next story is like House Republicans unanimously vote in favor of the Let's Become a Dictatorship Act of 2021. Yes. And it's like, and people are like, wow, yeah, these are the same. So you talked about it. There are real threats, and it's not, I'm of the opinion, it's not a partisan statement to just call it for what it is. The real threats are coming from the right wing in this country right now. And historically, like violence and stuff, like you look back at the 70s and stuff, a lot of extremist violence came from like left-wing causes, like environmental activists, mm-hmm. whatever. But the era we're in right now is like a anti-democratic right-wing movement creeping up on democracy, and Democrats not agreeing whether or not it's like a good idea to, I don't know, fix some roads and like guarantee some some basic assurances to the constituents that they promised them for the last like 15 years. Letting some coal freak from West Virginia like hold a gun at their I'm not gonna go there, but
that's like it's such a dark rabbit hole. As soon as you open your mouth and start talking about it, you're like, it's so bad. And yet every week there's like some new anecdote about like some right-wing person whose like talk was canceled at Oberlin, and like we're talking about this. Like why would this even be a story given everything else that is happening in the country?
So with these like real threats and these real things going on, what's your armchair theory for why we keep getting so much of this dog shit?
I mean, a lot of it is generational. I think that if you're, I mean, we're in the middle of a huge generational handover, that the Silent Generation and boomers have controlled American institutions for a very long time. And most of the people in power are people in their, you know, 50s, 60s, and 70s. They came up through the sort of the debates over the Vietnam War and the, you know, Clinton fights and Lewinsky and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, your thinking is very shaped by these formative events when you're relatively young, and those echo throughout the rest of your life. And so we have people who consider themselves liberals, but a lot of them are kind of more to the center. And then we now have millennials who are aging into political and economic power, and they are far to the left of older generations. And there's actually academic work on this, that the generation, the ideology gap between the generations is the biggest it's ever been. All that stuff about like anti-war protesters and the hippies in the 60s, it was actually a tiny percentage of the population, and young people are actually quite conservative at that point. And now young people are very much to the left, mostly because it's like more people of color, but also just like people are mad, and we, you know, we're growing up in very different economic circumstances than our parents did. And so basically you have this huge, this tide of left-wing people flooding into all of these institutions, and the people within those institutions find it, I think, annoying. Like, I think a lot of the stuff of, like, you know, changing language and complaints and, you know, people with dyed hair and all that kind of stuff, if you're an older and more sort of socially conservative person, you just kind of find it on a gut level annoying. And because they're in your ideological coalition, you have to see them. Right. If you're an editor at The Atlantic, you're probably not reading Breitbart and seeing like the deranged stuff that right wing people are doing. But like you're on Twitter and you see what people to your left are doing, and you're like, ugh, and you roll your eyes, and it's irritating. And that sense of irritation can very easily become, like, this is a national issue that needs constant scolding, right? Like, they feel like they have power over people further to the left in a way that they don't feel like they have power over Breitbart.com, which on some level is true. But the problem is when you open up the newspaper every day and there's two stories about left-wing excess and two stories about right-wing excess, normal people who are mostly, like, the vast majority of the country does not follow politics as closely as editors of The Atlantic do. And so if you're a relatively low-information person, as most people are, you're getting this sense that, like, the left is radicalizing and the right is radicalizing, and there's no real reason why you would think that one of those is more threatening than the other. And that's like the frivolous lawsuits thing. It's false. The threats are straightforwardly coming from the right. I know it's boring because everybody kind of knows it, and it's the expected non-controversial thing to say at this point. But the amount of coverage that an issue receives is much more important than what that coverage actually says. And even if you say in your article in paragraph 7, they're like, oh, the Republicans are worse. But anyway, here's another anecdote about some random person losing their job. People aren't going to internalize that. So most of the country is walking around with this impression that the left is radicalizing to the same extent as the right, and it's simply not true.
Yeah, most people read the headlines, look at the picture, and if you can get them through a few paragraphs, you have already got them further than most people.
Exactly.
My journalism professor back at University of Central Arkansas always used to say, the first hardest thing to do in journalism is to get somebody to read your piece to begin with, and the second hardest thing to do is to keep them there till the end. So how this is framed up, and even just the sheer amount of stories, does matter, even if these stories have all the, you know, like you said, the paragraph 7 that's like, well, let me take a second to acknowledge that my premise is wrong, but I'm going to keep going.
Yes.
And like,
But
if this matters, and I think that kind of gets us to a point of wrapping up here, which is that I have long been a big, like, part of the reason I got into doing reporting to begin with in college and for some years after, I'm back in research now, but like, I believe that people can only make decisions and choices for themselves that are as good as the information that they have. And I think what this kind of moral panic journalism ends up doing on a grander scale really kind of injustice to its readers, because it instills them with these impressions about our society that aren't normally or reasonably true. And whenever a person goes to triage in their mind, you know, especially when it comes to politics, what's important to them, the wrong things end up getting prioritized, and, you know, more space in this vacuum opens up for these truly just despicable forces in society that are trying to take away basic things like voting access and access to women's health care. I mean, there's a million examples there, but it's like, I don't know. Closing thoughts, Michael.
Well, I mean, I also think it's very important to note that when we've had moral panics before, they've mostly been driven from the right. They've mostly been driven by sort of majoritarian concerns, not minority groups. And they almost always result in measurable damage to the country. So the frivolous lawsuits panic and the nonsense story about McDonald's got us a decade of tort reforms. So it's now much harder to sue corporations than it used to be. It's hard to file medical malpractice claims. It's really hard to get workman's comp if, like, you lose a finger at work. Because all these states passed laws after this lawsuit and the panic around it inspired, like, real actions that made it a lot harder for powerless people to sue powerful corporations. And the stranger danger panic, this idea that, like, people are coming around in vans to kidnap your kids, got us a lot of, like, mass incarceration was driven by that. The idea that there are, like, these evil forces around us, we ended up strengthening all these laws that didn't make kids any safer because the dangers to children are almost all in the home. So every single time we've had one of these moral panics, we've ended up with real measurable negative consequences. And what we're getting now, like, the dark hilarity of this is that Republicans have been complaining about cancel culture and left-wing censoriousness, and, like, kids can't even hear ideas anymore on college campuses. And then immediately, you know, almost overnight, they pivot to banning, by law, critical race theory. So it's like, well, kids can't even be exposed to dangerous ideas, And then they want to ban dangerous ideas from schools, like day by day, right? And now they're kind of weirdly like switching back to the cancel culture stuff. But it's like, this is exactly the backlash. Like all of these deranged parents storming school boards saying like, you're indoctrinating my kids. The things that they are saying are exactly the things that The Atlantic and The Economist and The New York Times have been saying. Like these are the exact same talking points that the left is radicalizing and the left is trying to install a totalitarian Maoist dictatorship. So when you are saying exactly the same things as reactionary forces storming school boards, you should have a hard look at yourself and your coverage and the narrative that you are entrenching. And are you overall, in all of your coverage, not in paragraph 7, giving people a realistic sense of where the threat to the country lies? And they have not been doing that. And I end the piece by talking about journalists don't take seriously the idea of like their impact, what it means to entrench these false narratives. They want to pretend that they don't have any impact on society, and they do, and they should be really afraid of it. Like you're playing with a loaded gun, and you need to understand the context of the country that you're putting these stories into. It's like an invasive species. You can't just like put it into the lake and think that everything's going to be fine after that. Like you are the one putting it in there.
So I've been talking with Michael Hobbs. You've seen his writing in HuffPost. You've heard his voice on You're Wrong About with Sarah Marshall. And you could still hear it on Maintenance Phase, which is a great podcast. I just recommended it to one of my neighbors, actually.
Okay.
Really great show.
Hey.
Michael, because this is shitpost and this is going to be the test, I'll know if you really listen to the show or not.
I know what's coming.
I've got one more question for you.
I've been thinking about this all day.
What's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Okay, I don't know if you've gotten into this, but the last couple months, because I've been procrastinating stuff I actually have to do, I've been watching a lot of speedrun videos.
Like where people play video games super fast, right?
Yeah, people can beat Super Mario Brothers in like 4 minutes and 55 seconds. It's ridiculous. But then, so a lot of the speedruns are incomprehensible because there's like weird glitches involved. But if you go on YouTube, you can find speedrun explained videos where people break down speedruns and they're like, this is the weird glitch this person is using. And like, this is how to beat, I think it's like Yoshi's Island in like 48 seconds or something. But some like weird, you're like rewriting the code as you're playing the game. Anyway, they are lit and they are highly recommended.
Michael, tell listeners where they can keep up with you, your work. We mentioned Maintenance Phase already. I'll link that in the description. What else is out there?
I mean, I started a Substack the other day, but that's only because the only other outlet I had was a WordPress blog, and I also hate pitching things to editors, so I just set up a Substack. So it only has like one post on it right now, but I guess potentially I will continue to write on it. It's michaelhobbs.substack.com. So there's that. But I mean, you can find me if you Google me, you can find various places and things I've written.
All right. Welcome to the Substack, Illuminati.
Oh, God.
Together, we will take down Glenn Greenwald. Michael, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Jared.
That was my interview with Michael Hobbs. Thanks for listening. Please go check out his work. Maintenance Phase is a great show. He is a great writer. Do keep up with him. I think he has some of the more insightful and thoughtful commentary on our weird upside-down hellscape that we find ourselves in today. And I can't recommend his work enough. That's all I've got for this week of Shitpost. We'll have a newsletter next week and the week after. I'll see you here again, right here on this audio feed.